Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Our musical trivia questions come to us from the website excite.com. Question number one. Why did Rex Harrison, who played the male lead in the Broadway musical My Fair Lady, sometimes shout, "Where's my penguin?" during rehearsals? Is it A, he kept his pet penguin in the studio during rehearsals for Good Luck? Was it B, he was calling for his paperback book of the original text written by George Bernard Shaw? It was C, it was a slang expression he used whenever he was frustrated and needed a break? Or was it D, it was his nickname for his co-star in the Broadway show, Julie Andrews? So, where is my penguin? Question number two. The rows in Broadway theaters use alphabetical designations, such as row A, row B, and so on. These theaters, however, skip over the row I. Why? Is it A, Broadway performers are a superstitious lot and the number 9 is unlucky, so the 9th letter of the alphabet I is not a row in these theaters? Or is it B, theater productions require teamwork and the letter I puts too much emphasis on the individual? Or is it C, unlike the other letters of the alphabet, the letter I looks like a number? Or is it D, there are only enough seats in a typical Broadway theater for 25 rows? The letter I is the least distinctive of the 26 letters of the alphabet, so it is therefore omitted from the rows. Hint, here's a Broadway musical tune that indicates which of those possible answers is the correct answer. So, why do Broadway theaters not have a row I? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of August the 14th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1939, that The Wizard of Oz premiered in Hollywood, California. Judy Garland became famous for the movie's song, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. 1939, today. And it was 51 years ago today, 1969, that the Woodstock Music and Art Fair began in Bethel, New York. The three-day concert featured 24 bands and drew over 400,000 people. 1969, today.
Spring, won't you show yourself to me? The light is changing and the fire's out. I kept it going till the orange glow became the rising sun on my bedroom floor. I got birds on the feeder.
Kathleen Edwards, Birds on a Feeder, which is probably the closest thing to her title tune to her new August 2020 album, introduces our country and folk music news. It's from NPR. From August the 8th, 2020, Scott Simon and Ned Wharton, entitled Kathleen Edwards on Taking a Break from Music and Finding Total Freedom. Kathleen Edwards had devoted fans and a successful career with hits on the Billboard Top 40 charts and songwriting awards. But after her last album in 2012, she walked away from the music business. In fact, she opened a cafe in the suburbs of Ottawa, Canada, called Quitter's Coffee. It was hard, Edwards says, of her decision to quit music. I knew that I would feel guilty and that people would be disappointed or think that I'm doing something really stupid by walking away. But I had lost so much of my perspective and my happiness in music and in writing. After years off the road and with time to heal from singing about her troubles every night, Kathleen Edwards is back with a new album, Total Freedom. I really love now that I'm actually probably a far better musician and songwriter, given that I've taken time to have some life rather than be a singer, she says. NPR Scott Simon spoke to Kathleen Edwards about taking time off from music to tend to her mental health and her professional opinion on pumpkin spice lattes. Scott Simon asks, those are very powerful lyrics in the first song on your record. It almost killed me, and I always will be thankful for it. What happened? Kathleen Edwards replies, well, I think like many people in a certain point in their life, they commit to something so fully they don't come up for air often enough. And I think I probably just didn't do that. I committed myself to playing music and to having a life on the road. But I think I just needed to stop for a while. You hit a certain age when you're looking for maybe more in your life. I had not invested the time I needed to give that time and space. What did you find when you stopped? Well, before I stopped, I discovered the wonderful world of clinical depression, which I'd never experienced in my life. It took a while to really figure out that was what was at the root of my issues, my well-being. But when I stopped, I found relief. I think I just felt a huge sense of relief when I said, I'm done, and I'm done with music. And it just gave me an opportunity to not have this guy on my back kind of going, well, the next show is this, so get that suitcase out, have it ready, be prepared to stand up in front of people and feel vulnerable all the time. And it just gave me a chance to really build myself up again. Now that I'm well and now that I'm excited about playing music again and I'm reestablishing my relationship with it, I feel like people are feeling incredibly vulnerable right now. There's so much uncertainty. Why don't we just return the favor of all the kindness the people gave to me to empower me to keep going and put something out in the world during a time in which maybe someone needs it. What can you tell us about the song Ashes to Ashes? Well, it was at a funeral for a man that I didn't know terribly well, but had come to meet through him being a regular at my cafe, and I just had a great connection with him. He was a big music fan and loved Wilco. Where I lived, I didn't feel like I had a lot of people sort of show up and be like, hey, I totally get the world of music you live in, and here are all the people I love, and here's how many shows I've been to. So we had this wonderful connection about music that I really cherished. He was a gentleman who is, I think he was 42, which is actually now the age that I am. He was out shoveling snow, and I guess he got out to clear his driveway when he died suddenly of a heart attack and left behind three children, one of whom was, I think, maybe two. I went to his funeral, and when you lose somebody so suddenly without any sense, you're at such a loss to understand the moment. It was completely unfair that this family lost their father and their husband in such an abrupt way. I was just so angry about it, and I went home from that funeral and wrote that song, Ashes to Ashes. I think because mostly the funeral didn't bring me comfort, and I thought, well, it doesn't give me comfort. Imagine how it felt for them sitting there, not being able to understand what was happening. Does songwriting help? Incredibly. I mean, my God, she laughs. I saved so much money in therapists in the first 20 years of my life as a songwriter. I just used it as my outlet. Her album, Total Freedom, is out August the 14th. Once again, that's Kathleen Edwards. Strauss's The Nun's Chorus introduces our classical music news. It's entitled, Choirs Make the Most of Virtual Rehearsals During Coronavirus Pandemic. This is written by Peter Crimmins and published in NPR on April the 2nd, 2020. Normally, the Singing City Community Choir in Philadelphia meets every Tuesday evening to sing together. The 85-voice choral group, with members ranging from teenagers to 80-year-olds, had a busy performance schedule for this spring. But in mid-March, the world changed. Suddenly, everything stopped. No performances, no rehearsal, no Tuesday evenings together. There was an emptiness of not being able to connect on a weekly basis, says music director Jeffrey Brillhart. Shortly after calling the session quits, Brillhart discovered the Zoom conference call platform at Yale University, where he works as a music instructor. I thought, this is really interesting, he recalled. Zoom allows many people to call in and see everyone on the computer screen and talk to them, but often there is a slight delay. For a performance that's all about being in sync with each other, that can be maddening. So Brillhart sets it up so only one person can talk at a time. But for some kinds of music, like choral music, being together in the same space is essential. Being together is the whole point, but being together can be fatal. Despite growing concerns about the spreading virus in Washington state, where COVID hit early, a church choir in Mount Vernon decided to hold a rehearsal on March the 10th. 60 people congregated and sang together for 2.5 hours. Later, 45 of them tested positive for COVID-19. According to the Los Angeles Times, two of them died. Making music together is possible online, but it requires a different definition of what it means to make music, he said. It requires deep listening and comfort with silence, which is what I think this time is asking of all of us. As a composer, I am very interested in how these limitations can be used as inspirations.
The wicked old witch at first is dead. Ding dong, the witch is dead. Witch, a witch, a wicked witch. Ding dong, the wicked witch is dead.
Given today's anniversary of the release of the film, The Wizard of Oz, we have this article. The secret political symbolism you never knew was hidden within The Wizard of Oz. This is written by Genevieve Carlton and published on the 1st of July, 2019, in Ranker.com. The Wizard of Oz is a beloved children's story that includes both the book published in 1900 and the movie, which came out in 1939. For years, fans have drawn to behind-the-scenes gossip about the movie and the strange conspiracies surrounding The Wizard of Oz. But is there a secret political message also hidden in L. Frank Baum's book? It might sound far-fetched, but there may be evidence to support the theory that Baum was writing a political allegory through the lens of a fanciful children's tale. Baum was a political reporter in the 1890s who lived in South Dakota for several years, giving him a close-up view of the rise of the populist movement and the views of American farmers and workers. Is The Wizard of Oz an allegory for politics in the 1890s? Interestingly enough, there are arguably also some parallels to today's political scene, making even the would-be political allegory into a timelessly relevant tale. The goal of Dorothy's journey through Oz, at least initially, is to reach the Emerald City. The magical place will solve all of her problems, and the mysterious Wizard of Oz will help her return to Kansas. But Dorothy's initial optimism about the beautiful city quickly evaporates. As historian Henry Littlefield notes, the Emerald City represents Washington, D.C. And although Dorothy, the average American, believes that the entrancing capital city can solve all of her problems, she soon realizes that the city, like the wizard, may be more mirage than real. Although the wizard claims to be great and powerful, he's actually a charlatan. As Littlefield explains, rather than playing a specific person, the wizard is symbolic of the presidency itself. And, just like a politician, the wizard says, "I never grant favors without some return." A little quid pro quo? In the book, the wizard asked Dorothy to kill the Wicked Witch of the West. The request shows the wizard's lack of power. If he was truly so great, would he need a little girl to carry out his orders? Like American presidents, the wizard's power was an illusion. As a 4/1/17 article in Medium.com adds, the characters of the Tin Man, the Cowardly Lion, and the Scarecrow each represent one of the neuroses that, to a greater or lesser extent, live inside us all. The lovable on-screen characterizations help us come to terms with ourselves, and the wizard behind the curtain, telling us to look away and ignore the person behind the curtain, is a parable that could have been written about the current world in which so much is artifice, so little is real. And then there's the Oscar-winning song, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It's Yip Harburg's lyrics that make Somewhere Over the Rainbow such a special song. Human beings are dreamers. We all want to be somewhere else, doing something else, and sometimes with someone else. But we've got mortgages, families, responsibilities, bills to pay, and a position in society to keep up. Even people who consider themselves outside mainstream society have their position as an outsider to keep up, so there's no escape. The sense of wanting to be somewhere else, dreaming of a happier place, is exactly what Yip Harburg so beautifully conjures up in his lyrics. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops, far above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me. There's a delicacy to those words, but an inner strength, too. A determination to find a better place, combined with an acceptance that we haven't yet found the sense of comfort we've been seeking for so long. We haven't yet found where we belong, but that won't deter us from trying to find it. It's a dream, of course, both literally and figuratively in the context of the movie. But it's more than a dream. It's a conviction. It's an expression of faith that there is something better ahead. Somewhere Over the Rainbow is a comforting companion on our long and arduous journey towards happiness. Perhaps hopeful lyrics for today's world? Gee, Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water introduces our rock and pop music news. It's entitled The Songs of 1970. That was half a century ago, by the way. This is written by Jim Farber, published on the 2nd of August 2020 in Parade magazine. You can learn a lot about any given year by listening to its most popular songs. In 1970, the number one selling single was Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water, an ode to everlasting hope and unwavering faith. Nearly as popular were the Beatles' Let It Be and B.J. Thomas's Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, all songs meant to soothe and uplift. It's no accident singles like these wound up defining life in 1970, a turbulent year in America and beyond. It was a time of the Vietnam War, riots in cities, and following the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy. The music of that era was a band-aid for what was ailing us. Given so much unrest, everyone was exhausted. It's no coincidence that the top songs of the year were as much hymns as pop songs. But if such anthems brought people together, the bands who created them were, at the time, falling apart. Both Simon and Garfunkel and the Beatles broke up in 1970. Yet whole new genres emerged, making 1970 a banner year that will live forever in musical history and in our memories. These are the songs that resonated so deeply back then, we still sing them today. Need a Bridge Over Troubled Water? One of the most stirring pop songs of all times doubles as one of the longest. At nearly 5 minutes, Bridge Over Troubled Waters exceeded the airplay length allowed for most radio singles. But that didn't stop DJs from making it the most played song of the year. Its memorable title line was inspired by the old gospel spiritual, Mary, Don't You Weep, which contained the phrase, I'll be your bridge over deep water. Some Simon and Garfunkel fans actually thought Paul Simon's partner, Art Garfunkel, wrote the song because he sang it alone. That misunderstanding was only one riff that contributed to the duo split. By the time Bridge won Song and Record of the Year at the Grammys in 1971, Simon and Garfunkel had called it quits. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our second question, why are there no rose-lettered I on Broadway theaters? Is it A, the actors are superstitious about the number 9 and I is the 9th letter of the alphabet? Is it B, theater productions require teamwork and the letter I overemphasizes the individual? Is it C, unlike the other letters of the alphabet, the letter I looks too much like a number rather than a letter? Or is it D, there are only enough seats in a typical Broadway theater for 25 rows, and the letter I is the least distinctive of the 26 letters of the alphabet, so it is left out? Correct answer? Answer C. As noted in an article published in Excite.com on the 5th of July, 2017, there are no I rows in Broadway theaters in order to avoid confusion and disappointment if someone thinks their ticket says row 1. The letter I looks too similar to that number. By the way, softschools.com notes, in order to be designated a Broadway theater, the venue must seat at least 500 people. An off-Broadway theater must seat between 100 and 499 people, and an off-off-Broadway theater can seat up to 99 people. Although referred to as Broadway, the majority of theaters are not on Broadway. Most are in the quote-unquote theater district. Only 4 of the 41 Broadway theaters are actually located on Broadway. And the answer to our first question, why did Rex Harrison, the male lead in the Broadway production of My Fair Lady, sometimes shout during rehearsals, "Where's my penguin?" What was that? Because A, he actually kept his pet penguin on stage during rehearsals for good luck. Was it B, he was calling for his paperback book of the original text written by George Bernard Shaw? Was it C, it was a slang expression that Harrison used whenever he was frustrated or needed a break? Or was it D, it was his nickname for his female co-star in this Broadway production, Julie Andrews? Correct answer. Answer B. Rex Harrison was an avid fan of the original text, Pygmalion, by George Bernard Shaw, and Harrison wanted the musical to resemble its source material as closely as possible. At rehearsals, he would bring along a penguin edition of Shaw's text. Whenever a line of the musical's dialogue didn't seem appropriate, Harrison would shout out, "Where's my penguin?" The show's writer, Alan J. Lerner, decided to poke fun at Harrison's peculiar habit by procuring a stuffed penguin from a taxidermist, which he rolled out onto the stage the next time Harrison called out for his penguin. The joke tickled everyone, including Harrison, who stopped asking for his penguin and kept this stuffed bird in his dressing room as a mascot. Well, let's conclude today's program with a song from a Broadway musical that recommends optimism during difficult times. Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, from Monty Python's Spamalot.
And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. Life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long. Until next time.
Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep 'em laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on.